Welcome to the FMCG podcast. Make sure you're following us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us out. Enjoy the show. Hi, good morning. My name's Rich and we're Consumer Hub and we focus on recruiting consumer roles across marketing, innovation, sales and other verticals. And this is the FMCG podcast where we speak with some of the leaders of today and hear their insights into their category, expertise, their commercial knowledge and also their insights into FMCG careers. Today, we are really excited to have Brett Goldhawk on the show and he is the MD of Designhawk, which is his business that he set up, his agency. And his expertise is all around brand development, brand design, and also packaging. And we're really interested and excited to get into some of his insights. But over to you, Brett. Can you just give us a quick insight and intro into you and your business and what you do?
Yeah, sure. Lovely to be here. Thank you. So being in the industry for 25 years, it's sort of hot off the press that I started Designhawk on the 1st of March. So thank you for having me as my first guest as Designhawk. But obviously, previous to that, there was sort of managing director roles across what I would say some of the best agencies in London, and London still being for me the brand and creative hub of the world. I think that the very best agencies live and breathe here. Sorry for anyone that's outside of that. And I guess for me, Designhawk was really this focus on designing and fostering resilient brands. And what that sort of told me is sort of over a number of years, brands really get impacted by macro influences. So whether it's COVID, whether it's the cost of living crisis, the war in Ukraine. But before that, in 2008, we had a recession that lasted 5 years. And for me, yes, brands do need to switch between growing the category, but also sometimes it's about stealing market share during bad times. So for me, it's about getting brands to stand out, to be unique, being clear on who they are and what they do. And I think that's what creates resilience, really, for me. It's about knowing your audience, communicating clearly, consistently, and with conviction, but doing it over and over again and not flip-flopping between your marketing strategy, following trends, social trying to do stuff that just feels cool and relevant, but doesn't build the core. And I think that's what, you know, brand and marketing need to get back to, sort of really building the core and connecting over and over again with similar like-minded messages. So consumers can very eloquently go, I know what that brand stands for. It fits for me. Build a little bit of loyalty. Allow people to express to one another what a brand stands for. Because really, people don't really care about that many brands, particularly in FMCG. So trying to be really precise about who you are, I think allows consumers to better understand you and therefore actually buy into you somewhat. So I'm excited by the journey ahead. So Designhawk is very new, but built from 25 years of expertise.
Off the press.
So thanks for having me. Yeah.
That's great. No, thanks for the intro there. That's brilliant. And I mean, one thing that people, I think, are always interested and curious to know, especially if you're in the agency space, you get to be a bit of a voyeur and kind of peek under the bonnet of different brands. Can you just talk us through some of the exciting brands that you've worked with or campaigns that you've worked on over the years that you kind of just some little snippets you can share? I'd be really interested to give a bit of a view on that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating career because over the years, if I go into any supermarket, I've touched or impacted on most brands within there. So at the moment, we've got clients such as Green King, so lots of brands in the beer category.
Oh, I love Green King, yeah.
Grupo Bimbo, who have a lot of bakery brands. AB World Foods, that have a lot of brands such as Patak, Tabasco. Historically, I've worked with Energizer, Unilever, P&G, Marston's, Bottle Green, Rustler's Burgers. It's very fascinating because by being agency side, you get to work on so many different categories and you know, it was only a few years back, I got to spend 3 months in Toronto, Chicago, Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, Mexico City. So sometimes before, you know, when we could get on a plane, you get to go to other places and see culture, learn from people, understand how they shop. So building awareness is great. And I always say that sometimes agencies do their very best work when they enter a new category. So a lot of times someone will say, hey, we want you to work in jams, for example. And they say, have you got any experience in that category? And you go, well, no, but that means that we're going to be very good at it because we're not going to come with preconceived answers. I always say that if you work in a category too long, then sometimes you haven't got that curiosity or naivety to do really. Yeah. So yeah, it's fascinating. I literally, from a career I fell into at 18, 25 years later, I sit there and go, I'm very, very fortunate enough and very passionate about what I do. And I've got a wonderful team behind me that are equally as passionate. So yeah, it's great to be able to, I did a careers fair actually last week at my daughter's secondary school. And I said, it's really powerful to go into Asda or Sainsbury's or Tesco's and see your work on shelf and watch people pick it up. It's very rewarding for me.
What sort of stuff are you doing with Green Kinks? We've done quite a lot with them, and they're the business that I really like. You know, their beers are normally in my house somewhere on a cupboard.
So if you pick up a bottle of Old Speckled Hen, we designed that. If you pick up Green King IPA, we designed that. If you pick up Abba Owl, we designed that. If you pick up an Icebreaker, we designed that. And we've had a relationship with Green King now for about 10 or 12 years, and they're a fantastic client. Very collaborative. We work hand in hand with them. And for us, it's about building those distinctive assets and making sure that you're respected, you stand out on shelf, that you have this consistency. So whether it's a can or a bottle or a multi-pack, it's about bringing that consistency to life to make sure that you pop off a shelf.
And that's a really interesting point, kind of builds us to the next question. Like, what are the things that you always look for when you're sort of thinking through a brief and thinking, I've got to make this pop? Like, have you got sort of like a process that you go through? Like, what's your sort of methodology for making that brand pop and stand out on shelf?
Well, it gets kind of confusing, but I talk about, you've got to have points of parity versus points of difference. The points of parity is what I call category relevant. So you've got to look like you belong to the category. What are some of the codes that people are looking out for? And then you need... points of difference. So what makes you unique within that category? But at the same time, problem with creativity is people try to change things for the sake of changing it. And I think that you've got to build on those distinctive assets and not break memory structures. So you've still got to, people have got to see that you've enhanced yourself, but you're still true to who you always are. And therefore, design is a craft, and you need to make sure that you're not moving the dial too much. You're just reinforcing what makes you special. And that's really some of the good work with things like Old Speckled Hen. It was really about bringing through the uniqueness and distinctiveness of that brand, and it is quite abstract when it comes to how other brands in the category perform. And we just wanted to make sure that we could really craft into that and really land the message. So it's kind of not making sure that your desire for change overcomes the rational sense of you're already selling lots of stuff.
Yeah.
How do we make people can still find you and they still find you relevant? So it is an artful, and it takes a lot of collaboration with clients, a lot of testing with consumers to make sure that you're doing the right stuff. But yeah, it's a very rewarding, when you get it right, it's very rewarding. And you don't normally know you've got it right until maybe 12, 24 months later when you see the sales growth and
I think that's a really nice way of putting it. It's an art form. Like, there's principles out there. You know, if you chat to an artist, what good art is, like Kev Gayen, who's the artist that's done all our branding, and he's like done murals in our office. He can talk you through why he's kind of going for a certain angle and his kind of scribbly wacky style. He's got like a kind of like a design sort of archetype in his head, but also like it is art, and he's messing around with it. He's playing with it. He's teasing it out. I think sometimes there's a temptation, especially when we speak to like professionals coming through, they almost want the kind of cookie to cut template on. How do I become successful in this field? You know, like, what's the list? Almost like the rubric for the exam. How do I nail the exam? But actually, it doesn't really work like that, does it? It is an art form, isn't it? It evolves, doesn't it?
There is, and this is it sometimes, because I'm in the industry, I can see a new piece of packaging launch and I can tell you instantly which agency's done it, because some agencies have what I would call a house style. And I think that's quite dangerous. And I think that's when the agency puts themselves first and go, this is how we approach branding. And I can say, I know who done that. And I think that's what we don't do. We make sure that making the brand pop, not the house style come to life.
Yeah. And from your perspective, you've obviously got like a really nice 360 bird's eye view, kind of looking at lots of different brands, different projects, kind of seeing it all and how it fits together. Branding, packaging design, innovation, comms, that on-shelf feel, that tactile feel, how does it sort of fit together? How do you bring it together? Because it can be easy for those things to become side projects that sort of get lost by themselves, especially in bigger companies where you've got specialists that all do their own thing.
And the truth is, it doesn't. This is the fundamental issue with marketing. Marketing most often, and I don't want to generalize, but they start with allocating the largest budget to advertising, and then they drip feed the rest. And what you might find is things like shopper marketing and on-shelf impact, they should lead the way, but the budgets are really small. So, for example, I don't know what brand it was, but I saw an on-pack promo to give away Ninja air fryers, and they were giving away five. And therefore, they've got a national campaign, and they're giving away 1,200 quid's worth of products. That's a pathetic competition. That's just not impactful enough. And yet they probably spend 500 grand or £1 million on big above the line advertising. And when they've got the ability to convert purchase, and I say my whole positioning is that you should spend most money at the point where you can convert a sale. So it's all about in-store. So it's about shelf standout. It's about bringing the shelf to life. It's about shopper marketing. It's about on-pack promotions. That's where I don't think people spend enough time. And historically, brand manager level, they get all of the shopper activation. And then the marketing director works on the advertising aspect. So I'm going, you've got to flip it. In my mind, I think you should flip it and go, how are we going to bring the product to life in store for the shopper? And then if we've got money left for advertising and social, we'll spend money there. But for me, it's upside down. And I think if you flip the funnel, I think the brands would have a lot more success personally. Yeah. And the other problem you've got is so many companies, innovation for them is about chasing trends. So, for example, a great example for that at the moment is McVitie's by Pilates Global. They've launched Blissfuls, which is to hit the premium biscuit category.
Yeah.
They've launched all these products for HFFS to try and overcome legislation. They've just launched Tartlets, which is these kind of their discount sort of offer. They launched Go Ahead Holistics, which was for healthy snacking. And you sit there and go, you can't chase absolutely everything and expect you to have big impact. And, you know, they are in decline, whether that's real decline. Obviously, COVID completely messed up all of the marketing stats, and that won't settle for a number of years yet. But I'm sitting there and going, you're just throwing things and hoping it sticks. And I think that's the problem. You can't have an innovation funnel that is just like, hey, we see that trend coming, or there's some legislation about to hit, and just kind of throw stuff out there and expect it to stick. Yes, you'll get lucky with one or two, but I go back to that question, which is, what is the core of McVitie's? What are they trying to stand for? And I think that's kind of the challenge for me, is often it that nothing really sticks because they're not really being as joined up. For marketing teams that aren't usually that big, it's quite interesting how disconnected they can be, because they're different pods or silos doing their own thing. And that's the challenge for me. I there's not that many examples of fully seamless integrated. So one of our clients, I always put it up as the perfect example. We work with New York Bakery Bagels, and they're very specific on building cross-agency relationships. We have all agency days ourselves, the advertising agency, the PR agency, shopper activation agency. And we all sit down and go, what's the brief this year? What's our involvement? And we sign off the strategy collectively, and we challenge one another respectfully and politely. But because we all know our roles as well, we're not trying to grab budget. We're just saying, what's the best activation? Some years they'll lean on us a bit more. Other times it's leaning on the advertising. But it's really well managed by the marketing director, a lovely lady called Christina Hoggenfort. And she, you know, she's built that over 4 or 5 years where we can pick up the phone to another agency and say, hey, what are you doing here? How can we build it? How can we help? And I think that's the art form of marketing, bringing those really great creative agencies together to say, let's build the brand. And with NYB for specifically, this is what I mean about being resilient. They had Warburton's enter their category, right? Starting selling back. That is the scariest thing in the world. It's like a Coke or a Warburton saying, hey, we want a piece of your pie. And our strategy working together was to say, what's a resilient brand? How do we keep, let's not focus on what Warburton's isn't or is, and let's focus on what we are and how we grow the category. And actually, NYB has grown because Warburton's have entered the category, because now they've got a competition where they can say, hey, we are authentic boiled and baked bagels, and this is what we've always done. We aren't just a northern bakery trying to get a piece of the pie. So it's really good. To build that resilience in there and kind of go and kind of really understand what it is that you stand for and how you can approach branding and marketing and comms and work with those wonderful agencies collectively.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually, because Yeah, Warburtons, they do have a bit of a halo effect, don't they, on the categories they go into. And it's interesting because they're one of those brands that, like our kids, have got a really strong association with. They're not always in the house, to be honest, but whenever they're out and about with us, especially the little ones, they're like, oh, can we get the toast one? So in their minds, Warburtons, it is toast. And I just think that's genius. They've managed to kind of like influence my four-year-old so she associates the best toast with Warburtons. And she just knows straight away, that's the toast one.
But the problem is with Warburtons, if I'm honest, I think they're lazy now, right? Because at the top level, they spend a fortune on, remind me, there was the Muppets. I think there was Robert De Niro. I think we've had, was it either Arnold Schwarzenegger or Sylvester Stallone?
Yeah.
And they put all this money. And then if you look at their Halloween activation, it was Warburtons, and they sort of just changed their name to Warburtons. And then when you looked at their products, they hadn't done any product innovation, any pack innovation, nothing around usage or insight. It was going, just going to change the packaging because we'll sell more. And I'm sitting there going, that's lazy. That's just like, you've got companies that are going, seasonal is really important. How do we make an impact? Versus someone going, hey, we can drive some sales for no rhyme or reason just by changing the name of our packaging. And I think that's where marketing's got a role to play, which is do stuff based off of insight and impact and purpose. And when I say purpose, I don't mean that wishy-washy purpose. I mean, what is the purpose of it to grow awareness or drive sales, drive penetration, frequency, but have an outcome that is measurable, you know?
Yeah. Not just kind of bland opportunism that, you know, just come knocking, so I've done it. So I mean, just an interesting point there you make about, you know, New York Bagel, and obviously you've got something they want to stand for, which is, you know, authentic bagels. What can food and drink brands do to actually be known for something and keep true to purpose? Because it's easy to get distracted by lots of brand extensions or forays into NPD in new areas. You know, how does a brand maintain a desire for growth but also stay true to, you know, its actual purpose, as you put it?
Yeah, for me, I think it's always about building the core. It's about what I'd say consumer first strategy. You know, watch how people shop your brand, how they use your product in the home. You know, is there any life? Because people have this perceived of how products are used, and actually, when they get in the home, people have got freedom to use them how they want. What do people say about you? And just kind of get in store. I think that there's not enough time spent watching and observing and talking to people, and more hypothesis and theory and data analysis that isn't driven out of genuine insight. And I think that's the challenge. And I think that's, you know, with New York Bakery, they're really clear on who's buying them, why they're buying them, where the opportunity lies, who might buy them but hasn't, you know, bagels are quite an abstract, you know, boiled and baked, circular with a hole in them, you know, they're quite a strange little thing. So getting that kind of message across to what role it plays, is it breakfast, is it lunch, what do you put on them, how do you top it? I think that's the continuous journey, and not trying to sort of have this thing up here that is this super purposeful area that people don't understand. And I think that's part of the challenge for the brands, if I'm honest.
Yeah. What's your favourite bagel topping? Just to segue, because it's been discussed lots in our office at the moment. Is it a breakfast or is it a lunch thing?
Yeah, I'm a breakfast bagel kind of guy. I like the cinnamon.
The office settled, actually.
Yeah, cinnamon raisin bagels. Butter is fine, toasted, because I always toast my bagel. But I do like a naughty treat. I do love Nutella on it.
Interesting.
As well.
So I think my favorite is, and this is too calorific, to be honest, for my middle aged body. But it's the raisin cinnamon, but with butter and peanut butter. It's got to be crunchy as well, though.
Oh, right. So you have chunky peanut butter.
100%. It's got to be. There's no other way, really, is there? That's my view, anyway.
I went on this weird, before I got fat, I went on this weird sort of bulk diet, and there's certain things like peanut butter and bananas and porridge that I can't ever look at again, because when you consume something,
overdone it.
Now when I put peanut butter in my mouth, it just cloys.
You like, got hamster mouth when you have peanut butter.
Yeah. So I'm like, it might come full circle. I might fall in love with peanut butter again, but for now, I'm like, please keep it over there. Yeah.
So you touched on a few interesting points earlier, Brett. Like lazy opportunism was one, kind of NPD for the sake of it. Like, where do brands go wrong, typically? What are some of the most common pitfalls, and what can they do to avoid dropping into them?
It's a tough one, and you kind of have to look at a general level on this. So there's too much copycatting. Absolutely, in the whole of the industry, people are just copycatting. So a good example of, you know, everyone complains about Audi BrewDog, whether it was planned or not. They complained about Audi copycatting themselves. And then BrewDog bring out Blackheart, which is an absolute ripoff of Guinness. And then their whole activation plan is to mimic Guinness and turn up at the rugby and do exactly the same giveaways. And I sit there and go, if you got BrewDog that wax lyrical about being rebels and doing things differently, they are, I would say, probably one of the most copycat brands out there, even with the types of promotions they're doing and in-store. You've got the problem as well, which is brands are, it's getting that balance right. They're category-led. So they're governed by what retailers want. So when retailers say, hey, you've got to invest some money, etc., or you can't have that pack format now, you need to evolve, they just do it without really stepping back and going, well, if we've got to do this or they want us to invest, how do we invest properly and make the most of it? So they tend to just do what other people in the category have done. So therefore, you come across the same promo giveaways or the same gondola ends or the same on-pack promotions because they know they have to do it, but maybe their heart and soul isn't quite into it. And then obviously, you've got lazy seasonality. You've got innovation that is a global trend is a global trend. It doesn't mean as a brand that you belong into that trend. So instead of sitting down and going, hey, it's a £500 million opportunity, you sit there and go, but investment and time that we've got to do to take a small share of that, does our brand even have brand stretch enough to even worry about that? Or should we just get back into our core and make sure, you know, we're reinforcing that? Because that's what resilience is just to keep going and meaningful. And it comes down to me is, are you, some simple sort of benchmarks is, are you removing attention from the consumer's repertoire or their shopper profile? So, hey, if we do that, it'll make their lives easier. Or is it about a life hack? You know, if we give you this, it's quicker, it's faster, it's better, or, you know, it gives you some convenience. Is it about taste, you know, bringing new taste profiles to consumers? Is it about usability or unboxing experience? There has to be something that differentiates you from the competition. And it's not always the case, right? Because if you've got loads of money, and that's sort of Byron Sharp's piece, which is bigger brands grow exponentially because they've got more money to invest. The biggest surprise, for example, is Madrí Lager. Madrí Lager, for me, is 100% the most copycat beer you can ever come across. It's almost, they look to the category and go, what do we need to do? But because they're Molson Coors, they managed to get it distributed into almost every pub that you ever walk into, built that awareness, build the sort of availability so that by the time they came into retail, they're a £26 million brand overnight. Yeah. But at the same time, on reflection, their Carling brand is currently tanking. So, you know, there's always pros and cons, but if you're going to be a copycat, you've got to have a shitload of cash to make it work.
That's an interesting point, actually. And kind of on that point, so for brand owners, you know, SMEs that are looking to launch a new brand, maybe they've had some success, but they've spotted, right, this is a bit of empty space that we can move into. What are the fundamentals that people need to get right when they're moving into, you know, developing space, emerging space, and also they've got a new brand as well? Because there's kind of two things going on, aren't there? They've got to navigate to land well with the consumer and the shopper.
Yeah, but that literally comes down to, if you believe in your product, your whole strategy needs to be about getting that product in hand. Yeah. So it's not about I always come back to this, which is, if it's a new brand and you see something on social, you see it pop up on TV or out of home, and if you've never seen it before, it's not going to stay in your brain and resonate. So what you need to do is you need to say, look, if I'm getting, most startup brands will get a trial in a number of stores. And at that point, you've got to make sure that your rate of sale is really strong, which means that you have to invest. So you need to work out what budget you've got to say, are we going to do sampling? Are we going to pay for secondary sighting in store? Are we going to do a price promo to make sure that it's, you know, we might lose loads of money, but we maybe need to sell it for a quid. When you get to that trial stage, you've got to make that work, because you only get one bite of the apple where you kind of proof of concept, so to speak. And yet I see people go, they speak to me and say, hey, we're going to be in 500 Morrison stores. I say, great, what are you doing to get spend behind that? It's like, oh, we haven't really budgeted for spend, so you know, hopefully it'll work. And I sit there and go, don't go into that trial unless you've got the tools to make sure that it's going to work. And that even means, in my respect, of going, have we got people that are going to go into store and make sure that they're merchandised correctly, pull the products to the front and just get it sort of availability and kind of go,
yeah,
the trial. So we're going to maximise the opportunity within that. And I think that's the point. You've got to start small, but make sure that when you get those opportunities that you really maximise them and optimise what that opportunity is with sort of secondary elements, I guess, beyond just the pack design. And of course, the problem you do is you go to a lot of events and you see a lot of startup brands and you say, look, your brand's not even fit for purpose. You're at an event, you've maybe spent $5,000 for a stand. And I'm going, you know, brand and packaging design now doesn't need to be that expensive if you work with the right partners and the right growth opportunity. But you've got to land the holy grail is what does the product look like in your hand?
Yeah.
Right? And if you haven't got that right, it doesn't matter what you spend over and above that. It's, you know, you've not got that precious jewel that is going to get you traction, you know?
I mean, there's a few brands that have been all about Shopper in the last few years that stand out as massive successes for me. My favourite one's probably UFIT Drinks. So it's like, I think they've sold it now, but I just noticed that was popping up. Anyway, you get like an entry-level price point energy drink, you know, boost in convenience and impulse, particularly service stations, that kind of grab-and-go occasion. They were there. They just had the distribution. They were absolutely... And so they just very quickly seemed to build that association of, you know, we are a grab-and-go. We're there. If you want to swap out of energy and into protein, we're there for you. And that kind of Shopper occasion, that moment, they just seemed to own that. And then I don't remember seeing anything really that was massive above the line, but they had some really strong on-pack promotions as well with athletes, and then they've been bought now. But I just thought it was a just genius brand that seemed to come out of nowhere, but just seemed to absolutely own its occasion, own its space, and also own the Shopper execution as well. And quite simple packaging. You know, it didn't look like it had been designed by, you know, Da Vinci. But it was really fit for person. The messaging was super clear.
And there's always these examples, right? I love brands that sometimes don't look like they've been in an agency, right?
Yeah.
Bottle of Prime behind you, right? I talk about it all the time. It's such a phenomenon, but the packaging's just rubbish, right? It's just a solid typeface on a bold colour, but it's everything that's behind that. And I think there are, you talked about Boost Energy, you talked about UFIT. When a category emerges, there is always an opportunity for one or two brands, such as Boost or UFIT, to say the opposing competition are expensive. We're going to give you the cheap, accessible people. So UFIT, I want to get some quick protein. So, you know, Goodness Shakes, or if you're going to Holland and Barrett and you're buying the premixes, they're expensive, right? And UFIT just went, £1 a bottle, get 20 grams of protein, 25 grams, depending on what you bought. For people that would just get sort of not into bodybuilding, but maybe more into sort of understanding nutrition, sort of youngsters going, I want to build some muscle mass. I know I need to drink protein, but I've got pocket money, so it's a quit. That they successful, they're massively successful overnight. And then to take Boost at the other end, you've got Monster, Red Bull, who are growing the category. And then you've got, you know, I would argue that Lucozade Alert, that sits in the middle, is really poorly executed against that. They've kind of gone, hey, we're Lucozade, we should be doing sort of energy drinks, but they've not quite understood that properly. So I look at the shelf and go, yes, you've got Monster, which is great. That's my preference, hence why I've got one here.
Mango Loco. Love it.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of Red Bull, but I understand what they do. But then, you know, you've got everyone else that's trying to grab a piece of the pie. But at least when I look at things like, you know, Tyson Fury bringing out his energy drinks, at least there's something behind it that might attract certain people. Whereas Lucozade Alert, I'm like, don't get it. Not going to work. And funny enough, they launched, and I saw in store last week that they've already rebranded. So they know that the packaging's not quite working. I'm not sure, again, that the new packaging is quite right, because I don't think they've landed the proposition, the relevance to people. You know, Monster, Red Bull, lifestyle, they put so much into lifestyle activation. And, you know, you go to any of these extreme sports or these kind of rebellious events, and one of the brands are there. What's Lucozade Alert about? What are they trying to do, and how are they going to bring it to life? So it's a very difficult play for them, I'd say.
Yeah, yeah. And just finally, just you, touched a few times there on kind of you know, agency, etc. What would you say is the best way to get the most out of your agency partnership? Like, how can people sort of get the most out of their agency partners and really build some depth of collaboration that's going to, you know, basically make their money go further?
And I think it's about not coming with the answers to the agencies. So sometimes marketing, and I think that you said you had Gareth Turner on, right? Turner talks a lot about the brief, the agency brief. For me, the brief is about having clear metrics and what you're trying to achieve, but leaving enough open space to say, hey, I'm paying you to have some freedom of thought here. How do you bring it to life? So my whole positioning around what Design Hawk is about is to absolutely make sure that we have curiosity ingrained in the agency. So I spend so much time in a supermarket. If you ever look at my social feeds, always curious about the world around me, where the brand's going to exist and how it's going to work. But just keeping their eyes open to say, what is special about the product we're about to work on? But what's the current category dynamics and that curiosity of trying to learn all the time? Then you've got to have this kind of the agility aspect of kind of getting the best out of your agency by saying, this is what money I've got, what's the approach, what's the timings we've got across this, and not kind of, and have that real flexibility to work together and say, how can we maximize the opportunity within the budget and kind of make it work and deliver it within a time frame? And then of course you have to have the fundamentals of your agency, which is what I say about precision, which is you have to have that absolute belief in your agency that they have them creative skills to kind of go. So I traveled in the wrong direction. So I started sort of in the manufacturing space of print management and kind of understanding that if a designer does a pretty design over here, by the time it's on this great big machine in a factory somewhere being rolled off at, you know, 100,000 units every few hours or whatever, how do you make sure that the design intention and the creativity over here ends up being reproduced and being 100% consistent every time it comes off, every time it hits store? There's no problems with the packaging, no problems with the pack design. And that's not just packaging, that's any in-store shopper marketing. So I think there's confidence in one another, asking tough questions, being collaborative, and trying to build together. And I think they're the kind of the crux of a great agency partnership for me.
Great. No, that's really interesting. But for those that are watching, you know, maybe they're a brand manager in an SME and, you know, they're looking, they're thinking, oh, I've not got a load of budget, it's hard at the moment, inflation, maybe the brand's a bit tired, needs a refresh. Kind of, what are your top tips on what brand innovation managers can do to sort of re-innovate their brands without just chucking loads of cash at it? Like, you know, if you could just give one piece of advice and say, just do this. If you're not doing this, you need to start with this. What would your advice be on what they can do to kind of get their brand relevant again and bring it back to purpose?
Well, it's a bit like if you go to a networking event, right? Everyone's petrified and you say, what do you do? And you haven't got an elevator pitch. And if I was to take six marketeers all on the same team, put them into different rooms and say, give me two lines about what your brand is, they'd all give me a different answer. So once you've fully understood what role your brand performs in your consumers, both in their mind and at a functional level, because the problem with marketing is the intended message versus the perceived message, they never add up. So once you've got absolutely clarity on the role that you perform in a consumer's lives, then we can assess whether your packaging is conveying that. And then I'd say, if you haven't got much money, I go back to this every time, which is spend every penny on sales conversion. How do I get that product into a shopping basket, into a consumer's home, and make sure it's a really good experience for that consumer? Because if you and I, food and drink prices have gone through the roof. And are you ever sitting at home going, I'm sure that didn't used to taste like that. I'm sure that
all the time,
all the time. And you sit there and go, marketing and companies can't keep taking the good stuff out of products and still think that we're not going to see a difference. And I think that's the point, which is, for me, resilient brands don't get into this price battle where their own label is as good as. The moment own label is as good as. So, for example, because of Heinz baked beans, and because of, I personally think that I don't sense that the price increase was justified to the point where they are that expensive, I bought Asda Essentials and I did the perfect test, which is my daughter will only eat Heinz or Branston beans and I've never tried otherwise. I gave her a 30p tin of Asda Essentials. she couldn't spot that. And she can spot stuff, right? Because I gave her, I had a random tin of baked beans, Heinz baked beans, no added sugar the other day. And she was like, Dad, what are these? These taste disgusting. So for her to not, yeah, exactly. For her to not notice the difference between core Heinz beans and as to essentials is dangerous play now, because I have no reason to convert back. And I think because Heinz haven't invested in giving back to me, so they, if you look at Heinz baked beans, even Heinz ketchup, etc., they don't do on packs, they don't do price promotions really. They don't really, because they've got that huge, great distribution awareness, it's that kind of mentality, build it and they will come. They've not ever invested back in the consumer for a number of years. So for the first time ever, we're sitting there going, should we try alternatives? Because they don't really care about our loyalty. So that's a challenge of making sure that you're different enough that you're not comparable to own label. Because let's face it, supermarkets want to sell own label stuff, right? And they've got much better, bigger budgets than you. So I think that comes from building loyalty programs, on-pack promotions, giveaways, shopper marketing, all of that stuff that says, hey, you buy into my brand because we are a bit different and you can understand why we're different and how that matches your lifestyle and your needs and your desires, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're just coming to the end now, bro. It's been really interesting. Thank you so much. You've got about 3 minutes left, but I'm always really keen for anybody that's watched or listened, just joined in with us, that they can sort of reach out. A, thank you for your time, but also kind of follow what you're doing as well. And you've got some really interesting socials. Where can people find Design Hawk on socials, and how can they the best follow your work?
For me, from a social perspective, I would go LinkedIn. I think that kind of, there's still that element of what I love about LinkedIn. It's business to business. So we talk about knowledge building and insight sharing, but there's a bit more humanity coming through on the platform as well. So I'm an open networker on that platform. So if anyone gives me a follow on LinkedIn, Brett Goldhawk, follow me, and then you'll find Design Hawk off the back of that. Design Hawk's a new business, so we've got about few followers, so we could have a few more. But yeah, join us on LinkedIn. Find me on Instagram. I wouldn't. A bit of a random journey of a 40-year-old man doing exercising. Look at me on TikTok. I'm talking about Prime energy drinks. Probably not that great. So I'd say if you want the best version of me, I would go onto LinkedIn.
Sounds good. Right, well, no, thanks so much for your time again today, Brett. It's been really interesting. I've learned a lot. And yeah, I always enjoy these, especially when I learn stuff. And, you know, thanks to our listeners. Thanks to everybody that's watching us. Thanks for joining in. You know, do what you always do. Keep us posted on what you like, what you don't like. Give us suggestions, recommend guests. We love that. And appreciate all your investment in what we're doing here. And it's all about kind of giving back to the community. Brett, thank you again. We'll leave you to it and have a great day. Speak soon.